Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the all-new Opel Crossland. Beauty isn't scared of life.
There was no major government announcement accompanying the news last night that our lives were to be put on hold now for a further 9 weeks. The Taoiseach told the Irish Mirror of the new indicative date at the start of May or end of April, depending on your point of view, and then essentially said, hold on for further details next week. Now, there has been widespread disappointment expressed about the manner of the announcement as much as the content of the announcement itself. I'm joined on the line now by Roderick O'Gorman, the Minister for Children, to discuss this and other matters as well. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Philip.
Minister, we have an awful lot to get through in the mother and baby home situation, but it would be rather remiss of me not to talk to you first about another 9 weeks of lockdown looming ahead of us. When did you find out? How did you find out about this?
Well, look, I've been part of the Cabinet Committee on Education, which met on Wednesday. And I think it was clear to us there that NPHET's advice is that while we have, as a country, made really substantial progress in bringing down COVID levels, it's plateauing at a level at the moment that isn't enough. And we want to see the, particularly with the variant and its high infectious mm-hmm. rate, it's really important to be very careful in the context of the next reopening.
And but so I think now also, you're asking people to dig even deeper than they have already had to do, but you're asking them in this really rather bizarre manner of just letting it kind of slip out there on an ad hoc basis, as opposed to the Taoiseach may be asking RTE for airtime and saying, I need to speak to the people, I need to tell them why this is being asked of them, why such a huge imposition is going to be made on their lives. But no, they have to read it on the front page of the newspapers in the morning.
Well, look, I think the need to engage with the educational partners is really important, because everyone's identified that getting children back to school or back to childcare is absolutely essential. That's going to take some work in terms of the phasing of that. So we took the advice of NPHET. We're going to be engaging with NPHET further next week with a review to at the Cabinet on Tuesday, bringing about a clear set of phasings for, I think, bringing back young children in primary school first, along with the Leaving Cert class, and subsequently then bringing back the rest of primary school.
All very important, but that's not what I'm asking you. What I'm saying to you now is that neither you nor I nor anybody else in the country has a crystal ball. We don't know if this is the right decision or the wrong decision or not. But what we do know is what leadership looks like. And when you're going to ask this much of people, getting the political communication is right. Have you got it right?
Well, I think we'll be able to give very clear instruction and guidance to the general public on Tuesday in terms of revising the plan for living with COVID and indeed putting in place extra supports, because I think everyone is aware how difficult the last lockdown has been. Everyone I've spoken to has kind of said that this has been the toughest one yet.
And would you rather in those circumstances that the Taoiseach support? Would you rather in those circumstances that the Taoiseach had said something more formal than just letting it slip to the political correspondent of the Irish Mirror?
Well, I think there will be a formal announcement following Cabinet on Tuesday, where the full details of how long additional restrictions will be in place for, but also the full details on how we're going to begin to reopen education will be provided.
The news has gone halfway around the world by that stage. People have sunk even further into a slough of depression.
And look, you know, it's difficult to hear that there is going to be longer restrictions. But I think we are aware that the UK variant has changed the situation in terms of transmissibility. We have been really successful in bringing down the numbers from where they were in early January. But in order to facilitate the much wider reopening of the economy that we all really want, we need to bring those numbers down further.
And in the meantime, of course,
But just, Philip, just to say, we also are seeing the very significant ramp up of the vaccine program. We've got 280,000 doses delivered at this stage, almost 100,000 people having had the two doses. And I do think that's one thing that distinguishes this time from previous times. We have that light at the end of the tunnel that the vaccine represents.
So you say, but the communications are an absolute shambles, because last night you had your party leader, Eamon Ryan, supposed to be a full member of this government, going on air and saying that it wouldn't be wise for him to speculate on the timings. And almost simultaneously, the Taoiseach is telling the Irish Mirror, I know it's going to be another 9 weeks, but he's not attaching all of his political capital to that. He's not saying, this is me standing behind a podium telling you, the Irish people, what it is that you have to do and why you have to do it. He's just doing that kind of slightly sneaky, let's fly a kite and let's see how it's received.
No, I certainly don't think it's kite flying. We're aware how difficult the further increase of lockdown measures is going to be. And we're aware of the need to plan exactly what needs to be announced next week. That's why there's the meeting of the Education Cabinet Committee on Wednesday, and subsequently two meetings of the COVID Committee. Advice from NPHET, we want to make sure that we have the most up-to-date advice, and that allows us to make the decisions next week at Cabinet that are I suppose, as liberal as we can be allowed for in the context of NPHET's ongoing concern about, even though numbers are plateauing,
and how vigorous
at a rate that is still too high.
How vigorous an advocate are you for students around the Cabinet table? Because no doubt you've read these reports that show the financial disadvantage that children are going to suffer, the educational disadvantage that they are suffering as a consequence of lockdown. They need to be back in school in a proper educational setting. Are you reminding your colleagues of that on a daily basis?
I am, and within my own department, we were successful in keeping childcare open for vulnerable children and for children of essential workers. And that's something that we achieved through the great work of childcare professionals. The information and the research we did during the last lockdown indicates that the certain groups of children, particularly children with special educational needs or children from a disadvantaged background, were impacted particularly badly and had difficulty on the return to school in September. That's why we advocated during the October lockdown for keeping schools open. Mm-hmm. We were able to achieve that. Look, I think we were all very that we weren't able to keep schools open in January, but just the rate of transmission within the community.
So what next? I mean, junior and senior infants and 6 years in secondary school on March the 1st, is that a reasonable assumption for people to start making plans around?
I think we're looking at primary school in two phases. So junior, senior, first, second in the first phase, and the rest in the second. Now, again, these are...
Everybody from junior up to second class in the first phase, which would be March the 1st.
I think that's one potential. Again, these are decisions that will be made finally at Cabinet on Tuesday. But I think we're conscious of the need to balance the gradual reopening and the gradual increase of movement around the economy, but also that real importance of getting children back into that sort of routine and making sure that they have those supports in place. And I think it'll also just be important to ensure, and I've no doubt the Department of Education will be putting in place supports to make that transition back to education.
And that second phase then, Minister, that second phase, does it happen 2 weeks from then, or is the decision made 2 weeks from then with a possible return on the third week of March?
My understanding from my engagement with Minister Foley is that they're looking at the second phase in 2 weeks, but obviously all of this is contingent on ongoing engagement with NPHET and their belief that the scope of movement that's generated by the return to education is feasible.
And just fair, say fair also enough. Within, so subject within to the my, conditions.
Subject to conditions. My own area,
All right, go on. But then this is an important clarification.
Yeah, within my own area, though, I'll also be looking to reopen childcare. I'd be looking particularly at HA children who will be transitioning into junior infants in September, and HA students who are undertaking AIM access and inclusion model.
Is it a two-phase process, though? Does everybody go back in that second or third week of March? Everybody else?
What's been examined at the moment is that primary school would be in two phases. The first four classes on the 1st of March, and 2 weeks afterwards, the next four classes. Okay. But again, just to
and
be
secondary?
Careful, all of that is contingent on...
Subject to change. And I think everybody is sympathetic to what they want to see is clear leadership about what the plan would be, all things being equal. So all things being equal, then, and going according to plan, what would the second phase of the secondary school return be like?
Well, again, my understanding is the focus in this level is for primary school and the Leaving Cert class, and to see over those 4 weeks how that impacts. That'll bring us up to the Easter break, and at that stage, then the decisions will be taken in respect of non secondary school classes outside of the Leaving Cert class.
There could still be secondary school kids at home mid-April.
I think the majority, as things currently stand, I think the majority of secondary school children will probably be returning to education following the Easter holidays.
Okay, look, let's move on to the reason that we brought you on here to talk about the Mother and Babies Homes Commission and the Commission of Investigation Act. You've had time to reflect at this stage on what has happened. What's your understanding of whether the Commission acted within its legal remit when it deleted witness audio files?
Well, obviously, the Commission is an independent entity. In its engagement with the Data Protection Commissioner, it has set out the reasons why it undertook the deletion of the audio files. It states that it did that because it had given very extensive guarantees of confidentiality to those persons who had come before the confidential committee to give their personal accounts.
Which they dispute.
A number of them dispute, particularly they dispute whether they were told whether the audio files would be deleted or not. And I think that's the key point of dispute. And I suppose my focus at the moment is to see, is there a means of retrieving those audio files? Because I understand the real anger among survivors who feel those audio files have been
retrieved. So to that end, can we get into the nitty-gritty of that? And can I ask you, you know, who have you brought in from the Commission? Who have you quizzed on what happened to these audio files and what efforts have been made to retrieve them?
Well, I've been engaged with the Commission over the last 2 weeks on the actual status of the audio files. As I said to the Oireachtas Committee on Tuesday, the Commission responded to me on Tuesday saying they believe the audio files weren't retrievable. I'm not accepting that. I believe that I think we all know how difficult it is to permanently destroy electronic information. So I'm continuing to engage with the Commission to see if there is any technical solution available towards retrieval of those files.
Mm-hmm. And how open are they to that?
The Commission have indicated openness to looking at this issue, and we're tying down further details at the moment. But I will be looking for an independent expert to examine the servers, examine where data was stored, to see if there's any technical solution possible to enable retrieval, and I think that's absolutely essential that I am fully satisfied that everything has been done to secure those particular files.
Whatever about audio files, you as an academic would appreciate this, that when the Commission says it doesn't have any transcripts of any of those interviews, one would wonder, wouldn't you, how were they working from these interviews? How were they doing those interviews justice and the detail of those interviews justice if they hadn't transcribed them? And one would imagine that if there were transcripts, they must exist somewhere.
Well, when the Commission hands over its archive, its full workings will be contained within that. I'm certainly, as I
say, have you not asked them? Have you not asked them? Was there not transcripts of these interviews? And if not, why not?
Well, again, my focus has been on retrieving those audio files, which is the focus for survivors at the moment. Look, I think the last number of months have revealed that the overall approach of a commission of investigation to examining matters as serious and as sensitive as what happened in mother and baby institutions was probably not the suitable mechanism to go by, where you're trying to do two things. On the one hand, you're trying to undertake a legal and judicial investigation of what happened, but on the other hand, you're trying to allow for a truth-telling exercise to take place where survivors actually can give their account in a space that is safe. Both routes were tried with this commission of investigation, but that hasn't worked. And I think we have to look very closely at that legislation and consider whether something much more targeted and much more survivor-centred should be introduced for any similar investigations in the future.
And rather than let the commission dissolve, will you keep it intact?
Well, again, we're waiting for information from the Attorney General about what is feasible in that context. But an extension of the Commission's term lifespan will mean that survivors will not be able to access the information contained in the archive because the archive will not be able to transfer.
Could extend it for a month, surely, just because the deadline is so close at hand now.
Well, again, it's not clear if I can extend it for any time because of the manner in which the Commissions of Investigations legislation is designed and the manner in which it provides for extensions of the terms of reference of any Commission of Investigation.
Minister, having heard so much of the debate in the last couple of weeks since the report was published, I wonder, have you reflected on the variance between that report and what it is that you're hearing? And how do you judge the accuracy of that report now?
Well, I've been very clear that I hear what survivors have said about the language used, the coldness, the very legalistic nature of much of the language. I'd also be aware from my own very extensive engagement with survivors that the statements around adoption and particularly the questions around consent in adoption, it is difficult to reconcile what survivors have told me, what survivors state in the confidential committee chapter, with a statement that that basically said that women fully gave full and free consent to the adoption of their children. I don't think that's how we understand
it.
So
either the survivors are wrong or the commission is wrong.
But I think it is important, Philip, to say in the context of the finding that 9,000 babies and children died in these institutions, everyone was aware that children died. But no one, the actual scale of what happened and the detail to which the Commission has been able to document how many died in each of the institutions is an incredibly valuable piece of information and an incredibly valuable conclusion that the Commission has made. Similarly, the fact that they've been able to document that time and time again, the state was told by officials, by inspectors
there's a lot of useful information in there, but that's not the overall finding or conclusions of it. Leo Varadkar said the commission did a good job. Do you think they did a good job?
I think they've brought to light some incredibly important information on things that happened in these institutions, and information
Did they arrive at the right conclusion with all that information?
Well, in terms of the right conclusion, I think they were coming there. The terms of reference was to allow them bring a legal conclusion, and they have stated in areas that they didn't have evidence to bring about a legal conclusion. That doesn't mean that I don't believe the survivors, doesn't mean that the state doesn't believe the survivors. And that's why in the terms of the 22 points that the government passed the action plan in response to the Commission's report. Our action plan is very extensive in terms of dealing with information and tracing, dealing with burials legislation, putting in place a redress scheme, putting in place access to an enhanced medical
card. I'm not exactly hearing a ringing endorsement of their work here. Do you think that Leo Varadkar was wrong in his assessment that they did a good job?
I think the it's a vast piece of work. I think in terms of the language used, the language is disappointing in places, particularly in the executive summary, which I think doesn't do justice to the detail of findings that they made, really important findings in terms of what was happening in these institutions, and findings that will allow me as minister go to religious organisations and say, you know, you need to make a contribution to the redress scheme. And it is on the basis of the findings in the report that I'm able to do that. And I think that that has to be remembered as well. Without the report, there's no standing for a government minister to go and approach a religious congregation or a local authority and seek their apology. So the state's apology was based on findings in this report, but the report was never the end point. The report was just it marks the beginning of the state's response.
Absolutely, I've heard you say that before. So bearing in mind then that it is not an end point, do you accept its findings? In a word, yes or no?
I accept its findings in terms of the mortality. I accept its findings in terms of the long term failings of the state. As I've said,
girls and women were always free to leave.
On the issue of the nature of
there was very little evidence. Children were forcibly taken from their mothers. Very little evidence.
Yeah. Again, the commission have made that statement in light of the evidence they saw. When I engage with survivors, when I listen to survivors, it's very clear to me that they that their experience was completely different in many circumstances. And I believe survivors, and the government believes survivors. And Philip, that brings me back to the point I made earlier.
While simultaneously accepting the findings of the report, I mean, you can understand why people have a problem reconciling these two positions.
But I think that the issue is the one I spoke about earlier, about the unsuitability of a commission of investigation approach to investigating an issue like this, where you're trying to take a purely legalistic approach on one hand, but also trying to recognise the lived experiences of individuals. We tried to do that. This was tried with this commission. It hasn't worked, but that does not mean in any
Minister.
Way it shouldn't take away from the very lived experiences of survivors.
Minister Roderick O'Gorman, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thanks, Philip.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.